Hello and welcome to COCO Conversations, Exploring Complex Systems. Today we'll be speaking with Scott Henkel, a professor in the English department. Today Scott gave a talk at the COCO seminar, very interesting, and the video will be available and posted on the COCO Facebook page, probably within a week. So Scott, you want to say hi?
Hello.
So you are in the English department, and you're interested in complexity, and maybe being a snarky science side of complexity, I might say, what do you as an English professor, how do you even define complexity? What does that mean to someone who doesn't have mathematical rigor?
Yeah, that's right. Why do you belong here? Before I answer the question, I should say the English department folks asked that same thing about me, right? So wait a minute, you do things that are science-y, and you're in the English department. I've also been accused of belonging to philosophy departments and political science departments, but I like
that. I could see that from your talk today.
Absolutely right. I like that interdisciplinarity. Interdisciplinarity has been big in the humanities for a long time now, and I guess people ask me that why do you belong question because I take that interdisciplinarity a bit farther than most people do. So how do I understand complex systems? I mean, here's the mouthful that I always spout and repeat to people. Complex systems are nonlinear, non-hierarchical, self-organizing groups like swarms of bees and ants or computer networks. And my particular interest in it is the study of political movements, specifically the intersection of literary study and the study of political movements. And so how in the 19th and 20th centuries in the literatures of the Americas are political movements represented in those literatures? And one answer to that question is they're often represented as swarms. Mm-hmm. People use the language of swarms both to insult and to recommend political movements, and my research is making arguments about the way those representations of swarms come about in the literatures of the Americas.
Hmm. So that's a little bit about your research on complexity. How did you get interested? That's not a typical...
Yeah.
Hobby of English professors.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It came out of my activist life. I was a union organizer for some time, and it was a union that was very committed to direct democracy, to making decisions collectively in a non-hierarchical way. So during that time, I was a PhD student at Michigan State, and I wanted to know more about the history of direct democracy. And I started finding all of these things that were talking about non-hierarchical groups coming out of complex systems. So I just started reading around.
And complex systems is big at Michigan.
Yeah, it's big at
Did
Michigan.
Did you get to utilize any of that?
I didn't. I didn't make it down the road to Ann Arbor. I would have liked to. Knowing now, I wish I knew then what I knew now. This is one of those things. Yeah, it's one of the real centers for the study of complex systems. Scott
I'm,
Page.
I'm reading two of Scott Page's books right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, Scott Page is there. Exactly right. Exactly right. The Difference, that's his book.
Yeah.
And...
and complex adaptive systems.
Right. And that's really the part about complex adaptive systems really is my area. I mean, this is what we hope to see in political movements, right? That they not only are complex in the technical sense of that phrase, but they can adapt to things, take on new ideas, take on new people, go in new directions, mm-hmm. constantly regenerate themselves. In an effort to be durable and meaningful.
Mm-hmm. Durable, what do you mean by durable?
Durable, lasting, right? Yeah. That maybe they might not exist
when in... I think durable, I think flexible.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I think...
In terms of marketing, when something says, oh, it's a durable...
Is that right? Yeah,
I don't know. I've never looked at the definition.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'm wrong. But when I think of durability, I think of can it stand up? I mean, can it last? Can it operate over time? And that's how I think of it.
How do you see your work impacting the complex systems community and versus the general community?
Yeah.
Where where is the value in both?
Yeah. Well, this is the flip side to the why do you belong here conversation, right? I mean, I do find myself being sort of an odd duck in the complex systems world. There are few people out of the humanities and literary study in particular who do complex systems work. So the coupling of those two things is rather unique. So, I mean, I want to be humble, but I also want to say that this is something that I'm doing that relatively few people in the complex systems world are doing along with me. So I hope that I can make a contribution that that breaks some new ground. I hope to. Yeah.
And in terms of, it's similar actually for both, bringing the complex systems to the English and the English to the complex system.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I hope my title this morning was, the subtitle was Complex Systems and Critical Theory. And I really do view my work is taking methodologies from both complex systems and from critical theory, and I mean this is one of the ways that new knowledge gets produced. You put two things together that haven't been put together before, and you see what comes out of it.
The critical theory, you defined it for us this morning, and it went a little fast for me to.
Sure.
Can you go over that again?
Yeah. So. Let's just say this. Humanistic study, literature, history, philosophy are all part of the humanities. And the most basic definition of humanistic study that I have is that it's the study of the human condition. And critical theory is a fairly contentious thing. So lots of traditional theorists will say that humanistic study should be devoted just to understanding the human condition, right? So what does it mean to be human, right? What does it mean to be human in a particular historical era? What does it mean to be human in a particular literary text or so forth? And for lots of people, that's sufficient. And you know, I have no argument with the people who think that is the sum total of humanistic study. But there are others of us, myself included, who think that the study of the human condition shouldn't end at just understanding what the human condition is, but attempting in some way to improve it, right? I mean, this is very difficult and very contentious because people have differing views, not only of how to interpret the human condition, but what a good human condition would be. You know, so I mean,
and the an improvement you would think of more in an applied school, like the public administration.
Maybe
that's what they're charged with, is improving the. I don't know.
They could be. I mean, certainly the folks in public administration.
Or nursing, you know, they do a lot of community health.
That's right. Absolutely. And the humanities certainly aren't the only disciplines that view themselves as sort of helping out the human condition, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, engineers building better bridges, right, can certainly help us out. And scientists who study diseases can help us out in all sorts of ways, right? So in the humanities, we often talk... So to track back, some people think that to interpret the human condition is enough, and others, such as myself, think that interpreting the human condition can lead us to not only understanding it better, but helping to alleviate some misery in the human condition, right? I mean, the examples that I cited this morning at the top of the presentation, there are lots of people who live with poverty, injustices of all kinds, right? Inequalities of race, inequalities of gender, inequalities of class, inequalities of political enfranchisement and disenfranchisement. And one of the things that critical theorists in the humanities try to do is to work on those problems and hopefully to alleviate them in whatever, maybe small, maybe large way that we're able to do. So people talk of critical race theory, critical class theory, critical gender theory, and it's very contentious.
So the critical is that it's urgent. It's like critical in the sense that I usually think of. Critical.
Yeah, it could be like it could be urgent, but critical more in the sense of critical thinking.
Okay.
Right. The Harvey quote that I gave at the top of the presentation was something like, "There's a lot of people who have thought about the world in very serious ways." Right. There's a history to critical theory that we need to look at and to interact with as we do our own work.
Yeah. So. Do you you said before that you have been accused of being a philosopher, a political scientist, those types of people.
I like those accusations.
Do you actually get to do any direct interdisciplinary work with them?
Yes, I do. I'm involved with the new Institute for the Advanced Studies in the Humanities here at Binghamton University, right near to the coffee kiosk in...
What is that?
That's right.
Maybe it's new.
Don't get over to that part of campus. It's in the library building on the first floor, near to the elevators, but the Institute for Advanced Studies in the Humanities...
is that by the grad lounge?
It is by the grad lounge. It's exactly right next to the grad lounge. Although it's under construction at the moment, they're holding their meetings somewhere else. Anyway, but it's an interdisciplinary research group that draws from people with research backgrounds across the humanities, and the humanities vary broadly. We've had people in the social sciences also participate in the group. But it's a group that comes together once weekly to share work and to discuss new work, to cultivate ideas, much like the COCO group does. It's really fantastic. It's really made up of lots of energetic and interesting people. So,
are graduate students and maybe even undergrads invited?
Yes, both are. The Institute for Advanced Studies offers fellowships for faculty members, also for graduate students, and I don't know if they're called fellowships for the undergraduate students, but undergraduate students can apply and take on research projects as long as they're working with the faculty member in some way on it. But yes, and also community members. They also, IASH also offers fellowships to members of the community who are working on projects that speak to the group's aims.
Huh. Are these videotaped or?
They aren't videotaped. They probably should be, but they aren't.
Okay. So if the videos do come in the future, we'll be sure to post them and give them some social media play.
Absolutely. That would be really great. That would be really great. They are open to the public. Yeah. And of course, they are advertised on the
Beeline
and Dateline and those sorts of things. But they usually meet weekly on Wednesdays.
Okay. Great. Let's see. Oh, so I kind of jumped ahead with that question, but going back, so you were talking about critical theory. So that's the English side of the methodologies that you use. What about the complex systems side?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I have to admit to knowing very little methodologically of what comes out of the sciences. I have little experience in putting together models and, you know, running computer models and things along those lines. So what I talked about in my conversation this morning was the differences in methodologies. And methodologically, I'm very much in the humanities rather than on the complex system side. You see, the evidence from my presentation takes the form of direct quotation from the text. So I draw on lots of complex systems text, like Thomas Seeley's Honeybee Democracy, which is a book that I like very much. But rather than drawing on his experimental data for my evidence, what I draw on is the narrative that he writes about it.
So this is interesting. So the idea is to analyze using the English methodologies, but looking at books, science books, as almost as literature.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, okay.
That's right.
It's all coming together for me now.
Good. I'm glad.
Great. Well, I guess we could get into more specifics about your swarm work.
Yeah, sure.
And why not? I mean, talk about these Occupy, this Occupy movement and how it relates to your research and how timely things are for you.
Yeah, good. It's probably, you know, I hope it's not, but it's probably the one time in my life when my research is timely and relevant to outside events going on. The Occupy Wall Street protests explicitly argue that they are a non-hierarchical, leaderless organization, which rhymes with my research in all sorts of ways. One of the things that my research does is to track the language of swarms and swarming through the 19th and 20th centuries. And one of the things that I found is that many people use the language of swarms and swarming to insult political movements.
Thomas, just like a mob, thinking of it more as like a mob mentality.
Exactly right.
You're just a following. You don't.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or like hooligans. Yeah. You know, the soccer hooligans.
Soccer hooligans. That's right. They're called dirty hippies in our day. During the American
swarms of dirty hippies.
Swarms of dirty hippies. Yep, that's right. Very interestingly, you know, the language changes over historical eras, but the idea sort of remains. During the American Revolution, the crowds and mobs were called a motley crew, mm-hmm. which is very interesting. I taught the book The Many-Headed Hydra to my Literature of Global Political Movements class last week or the week before, and they were interested in what they only knew as a 1980s rock band. there was a history behind the phrase Motley Crue. But yeah, when you see people condemning dirty hippies, unquote, today, that language was different during the American Revolution. They were called Motley Crue. So anyway, the research tracks the use of the language of swarms and swarming. And I've put together quite a list of authors who use the phrase more often than not in pretty negative ways. Mm-hmm. So Thomas Carlyle, for example, in an essay titled Shooting Niagara, uses the language of swarms to describe labor movements, women's movements, and he especially uses it to insult the abolitionist movements during the 19th century in the United States. It's clear.
So maybe it means things that at the time people were against, but in the future were looked back on positively.
Yeah, well, I mean,
that seems to be
that's clearly
the trend.
That's clearly one of the things that that I would like to see. Right? I mean, when people look at a political movement, they don't really know what to think about it, often they default to the language of swarms. I mean, this is, I mentioned in the talk, this is one of the things, if you look through the New York Times reportage and the NPR reportage about the Occupy Wall Streets, they also use the language of swarms, swarming. But Thomas Carlyle and many others use it as an insult. What Carlyle means when he calls people bees is he means that they are acting as subhuman. Mm-hmm. Means that they
robotically.
Are... Robotically. They aren't thinking. They don't have, you know, bees, for all of their virtues, probably don't have the capacity for abstract thought that humans do.
Right.
So when Carlyle calls these activists, women's activists, labor activists, anti-slavery activists, you know, buzzing little bees, he means to insult them and say that they aren't acting as humans should.
Right.
They're not using
Well, I guess even
with
the insect language, there's drone insects, right?
That's right.
So
that's right.
There's kind of that implication, I think.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's a big part of it too. Many people, including Thomas Seeley, have to dispel the myth of the queen, right?
Mm-hmm.
The language that we use still to describe the behavior of swarms is a very hierarchical language. In fact, it comes from monarchies. We talk about queen bees, right? And also we talk about worker bees, right? And if you look at that language, I mean, it would be reasonable to expect someone who doesn't know anything about bees scientifically would say, well, clearly the queen is the one who tells the workers what to do.
Right.
So the very language...
And that's how children's stories portray it.
That's right. It was the Disney movie Ants or something along those lines. There was one ant who was like a sergeant or barking orders to everybody else. And, you know, this
Woody Allen.
Was it really?
Yeah, Woody Allen was the little wandering, not knowing what to do ant.
Yeah, interesting.
Who didn't like his lot in life.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll have to go back and watch that movie. Yeah.
Thinking Woody Allen.
Very good. Very good. Yeah, so I track that
language.
So I track that language, and you know, one of the things that literary studies can do, I hope, or can contribute to the study of complex systems, is to think critically about that language. Mm-hmm. Maybe we need different language to describe the behaviors of particular bees and ants in a swarm.
Hmm. Yeah, no, the language issue is definitely very fascinating. One of the reasons we start the show off every time with how do you define complexity.
Yeah.
Is because there isn't one formalized
that's
definition.
Right. That's right.
One of the issues. The other is that it's become a popularized term.
That's right.
On my other show, Sustainable Binghamton Radio, we asked the same question about sustainability, mm-hmm. because it's also become this, what does it mean when someone actually says it? What's the intent?
Yeah.
So I think this is very important.
I do too.
For complexity, because what do we mean when we say it? What does the media think we mean when we say it?
Yeah. That's very hard. Right. But also very interesting. So yeah. I think a couple of things about that. So as a good literary scholar, I mean, one of the things that I might say is that all language is always open to interpretation, mm-hmm. right? We may think that we're conveying a particular meaning, but sometimes the people around us hearing it may intuit or interpret a very different meaning out of it. And while that's very frustrating at times, it's also very interesting. Language is this plastic, changeable, interpretable thing that makes the study of it always shifting, always changing, and interesting in my mind. The other thing is that while the study of complex systems is not brand new, there have been people who have been doing it for a long time, discipline-wise, it's still pretty new. It's still pretty new. So there is an element of asking lots of people what their definition of complexity is. And
so that we can formalize it.
Yeah, yeah. Or even, you know, to continue to debate what it might be.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, on the one hand, we need a good working definition so we can get to work on it.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, if it's so amorphous that we have nothing tangible to study, that's a problem. But on the other hand, if it's so singular and easily definable, then it sort of takes the interest away of doing it, right? I mean, there's something exciting about playing, admittedly, a small part in a relatively new discipline.
Mm-hmm. Is there much more we can say about leaderless groups? Because I feel like you're writing a whole book on it.
Yeah, there's a lot we can say about leaderless groups. First of which is there's just a ton of doubt out there about whether they can exist at all.
Right, or for how long.
Or for how long.
The durability
of it. Yeah. Exactly right. And so the question I asked this morning is sort of like the third question after that. So question one is, can they exist at all? Question number two is, if they can exist, then for how long? And
right.
Then question number three probably is, if they can exist for some period of time, what are they good at? Or what are they good for?
Right.
But perhaps we should start at question number one. The video will be about question number three, but let's start at question number one. There's so many people, especially those who... So people who study complex systems are much more comfortable, of course, with the idea of leaderless groups. Complex systems scholars have seen lots of evidence from bees and ants, right? For example, and they're more comfortable with it. But when talking to...
Talking about consciousness.
We're talking about consciousness.
That's another big one that we like to talk about.
Yeah, good.
There's no little man in your brain controlling your brain.
That's right.
So.
That's right. It's a collection of cells.
Right.
It's a networked collection of cells.
Right.
So when you talk to people who have little experience studying complex systems, there's a lot of doubt out there that a leaderless group can function at all, a non-hierarchical group can function at all. Several reasons for that. Number one, because as I showed in my presentation, there have been very strong arguments for the virtues of hierarchy over the years. In fact, these are very ancient aristocratic arguments. And people's daily experience is more often than not with a hierarchy at work, at school, right, in community groups than it is with a direct democracy, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, to what degree do you have control over your boss at work in the average U.S. workplace?
Right.
And I think the answer to that question is very little, because the vast majority of American workplaces, for example, are organized hierarchically.
Right.
You have a boss at the top who tells the managers what to do, who in turn tell the workers what to do. And of course, there's always, there's some play, even in hierarchical organizations.
And we know there's issues with that because of, what is it, Peter's Law?
Tell me what Peter's Law is.
That when you retire or when you leave, you exit at one position higher than you actually deserve to be at. You get one more promotion than where you're actually competent.
That's interesting.
So
that's
there's
interesting.
A lot of these Peter Laws people in and high positions.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
They
deserve to be at the position below, but they did very well at that.
Yeah.
So then they got promoted.
They go up.
And then that might not be the right fit.
That's right. That's right. And we can see all sorts of examples of that. Can't wait. The old aristocratic argument is that those, for example, who are best at governing ought to govern.
Right.
And, I think it would be quite a stretch to look at the political system under which we live and look at all of our elected representatives and say, yes, in fact, those people are the ones who are best at governing. Bless their civic-minded hearts for wanting to do the job.
When I'd say bless their families.
Yeah, bless their families. Exactly right. Exactly right. There are strong currents in American politics for valuing ignorance and for dismissing facts in favor of belief, for example. And it's difficult for me as someone who values intellectual inquiry to look at that sort of behavior and say, yes, in fact, those really are the best people who ought to be governing.
Right. Mm-hmm. You talked a little bit about this popular term, wisdom of the crowds.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you want to speak to that?
Yeah, sure. Well, it's a play on the madness of crowds, right? There's a long history of authors, including Nietzsche, Thoreau, who on other political questions is very, very good. But there's a long history. Nietzsche said, I think this might be a direct quote. If it isn't a direct quote, you can look it up and slide the direct quote into the podcast. But he wrote in Beyond Good and Evil that something like madness is rare in individuals, but in crowds it's the norm. Something along those lines, you know. And he's just one of many thinkers who have believed that when individuals combine with others, they go into a herd mentality. They either lose or don't exercise their critical thinking skills and become lesser than they ought to be by virtue of working with other people collectively.
Right. And which I can say, when I've been in huge crowds,
there's
debt. You feel emotion.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
I would say that I can understand where he's coming from because
I can
feel it.
Yeah, that's right.
I can feel my feelings more tactily than normal.
That's right. That's right. I think that's true. And we can see the basis of why Nietzsche and others would say things like that. And excuse me. It's also true to say that not all groups exhibit complex behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Some groups come together and they are lesser than the sum of their parts. But one of the things that complex system gets us is the ability to, or the opportunity to, analyze the dynamics of particular groups. So what makes one group complex and therefore, for example, very good at making high quality decisions?
Mm-hmm.
And what are the characteristics of groups that debate endlessly without coming to a good decision, or who interact collectively but never exhibit emergent characteristics, meaning are better than the greater than the sum of their parts.
Right.
I mean, obviously,
if everyone just follows the leader, you can simplify it down to just the leader.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
Cool.
I forget where I was going after that.
But because we were talking about the wisdom of crowds.
Oh, that's right. The wisdom of crowds. That's
and so the idea that complexity. And the models and simulations that we've been doing show that with certain rules, you can generate these behaviors.
That's right.
So
that's right.
It is possible.
That's right. That's right. And one of the tasks of complex systems scholars then is to figure out what those rules are, how to apply them best, in what situations will they work, in what situations won't they work. This morning during my talk, I referenced the jelly bean experiment, where you fill a big jar full of jelly beans and you have everyone in the room take a guess about how many jelly beans are in that jar. And what most people would think, and they would look around the room and say, okay, that person there is really good at math, for example, right? So I'm going to say that one person who's good at math is going to have the best guess.
I would put my money on a cook.
A cook, there you go.
Because they are very good at judging how much a container will hold.
That's right.
We did a mini experiment. So,
is that right?
Yeah, where we held up I got into a debate about a similar thing and about how much, because in Jewish law we have all these laws about kashrut, and if you get a percentage or, you know, it's all these rules, and we said, well, how could you really be able to eyeball that? Yeah. How could you really know? Yeah. And so we held up containers, and my friend's mom was like, well, that's a cup, and that's a half cup. Wow. You know? So, and we filled them with water, we measured, and we're like, how, you know, and they were not normally shaped. So.
Yeah, sure.
I don't know. But
that's
anyway,
very impressive.
So that cooks may be a disclaimer. Potential,
yeah, that's
potential
good.
If we were going to really scientifically follow this up, but in general,
we'll have to test that.
Yeah,
we'll have to get together a room full of 10 cooks or so, and we'll see. Because so two things. One, the jelly bean experiment, as you and perhaps the listeners well know, is that when you average all of the guesses, the average consistently turns out to be better than the best individual guess.
Right.
But with the cooks, who are all highly skilled at judging volume of jelly beans or flour or whatever, it would be very interesting to see if it holds.
Right.
You did that experiment.
No, I didn't do the proper experiment.
We should do that.
We got into a Talmudic argument.
Yeah.
And it turned out that my friend's mother
could do it.
Could do it.
Of
course, it was with water, not with jelly beans, which is probably a harder task.
Well, we would have to do the experiment then in two ways. We would have to run it first with jelly beans, and then we would have to run it with something that she has a high amount of skill, and her other nine friends have a high amount of skill. So,
This a little bit reminds me of the lady tasting tea, which is a story they tell in statistics class of a woman who claimed that she could tell the difference between a cup of tea that had the milk poured in first versus the milk poured in second.
Yeah.
So it's just these kind of scientific questions that arise from just talking.
That's great.
You know?
And can she tell whether the tea was poured in first or the
That's what they never they no one actually knows the end of the story.
No one knows.
But there's a book called The Lady Tasting Tea that goes through the history of and development of scientific experiments.
Really?
And it starts out with that story.
The Lady Tasting Tea. I'll have to look for that.
Yeah. So I guess we're at time. So thank you so much for coming on the show and coming to speak at COCO. It was really pleasurable
as
a listener.
Thank you. I'm glad.
Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.